From the Sky News Centre at 6, it's feared a second person in the UK has died after contracting coronavirus. The man, who was in his 80s, was being treated in Milton Keynes and had underlying health problems. 163 people in the UK have tested positive for COVID-19 so far. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, says we can expect to see a lot more.
It looks to me as though there will certainly be a substantial period of disruption when we have to deal with this outbreak. How big that will be, how long that will be, I think is still an open question, but clearly it is something we're going to have to deal with for quite a while.
Meanwhile, the government's called a meeting with sports governing bodies and broadcasters to discuss how they would cope with a broader outbreak of the virus. They'll get together on Monday to discuss all outcomes, including the possibility that some events could be held behind closed doors. A British woman has gone missing on the South Pacific island nation of Fiji. 23-year-old Lydia O'Sullivan from Cumbria usually messages her family every day, but hasn't been seen or heard from for a week. Four men have been arrested on suspicion of attempting to traffic children into the UK. Officers found 10 people thought to be from Southeast Asia in a lorry near Ghent in Belgium yesterday. Sport and Tottenham boss Jose Mourinho says Eric Dier will be available for selection for tomorrow's Premier League game with Burnley. The Football Association's investigating after he confronted a supporter at Wednesday's FA Cup defeat at home to Norwich.
Everybody understands what happened, and to be honest, what happened happened. And let's move. And the only thing that matters is, first of all, that nothing really big happened. And secondly, he played so well in the last two matches that, of course, he's going to play.
And Genesis have added 6 new dates to their reunion tour. Tickets sold out in less than 10 minutes this morning. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Secker.
Here is an update from the government and the NHS about coronavirus COVID-19. If you have returned to the UK from Southeast Asia, Italy, or any other country with reported infection in the last 14 days and developed symptoms of cough, high temperature, fever, or shortness of breath, do not visit your doctor or hospital. Stay indoors and avoid contact with other people as you would with the flu. Call NHS 111 to inform them of your recent travel. Precautions for all of us are to cover mouth and nose with a tissue when we cough or sneeze. Put used tissues in the bin straight away and wash your hands with soap and water often, using hand sanitizer gel if soap and water are not available, and avoid any contact with people who are unwell. The coronavirus can spread from person to person in cough droplets, but it's highly unlikely it can spread through packages from affected countries or through food. While the risk to people in the UK is low, these steps can help reduce the spread of infection.
BCFM plays more Bristol music than any other station.
Top of the evening, boys and girls. It's the unmistakable sound of the Politics Show. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in this week for Tony Gosling, who's on his holiday halls. It's been a momentous week locally. We've got much to discuss with my two guest councillors for this evening, Labour's Afzal Shah and Lib Dem Tim Kent. Obviously, we are fully democratic in our participation in all political discussion. If you'd like to contact us this evening, 0117 911 3307 or studio@bcfmradio.com. If you'd like. like to send me a text message. I particularly like those because it leaves a digital fingerprint. 607 is the number, started with BCFM. It comes straight through to me here in the studio. And I'm delighted to welcome back, as every week, Martin Summers. It's been a busy week. There's a lot to discuss in the second hour of the show. Coronavirus, I think, should be near enough the top of the list. Bullying in the workplace seems to be very much a la mode this week. And I'm sure as we look overseas and beyond, we're going to have plenty to discuss too. Welcome to the studio, Tim Kent, Lib Dem, for Hengrove and Whitchurch, Willywood.
Hengrove and Whitchurch Park Ward.
Thank you very much. With soon to be 3,500 extra houses somewhere local.
Yeah, about 3,000 to 3,500 extra properties are being built in my ward.
What fun. And Labour's Afzal Shah, member of the Planning Committee, who said that was a good idea. You are the Labour councillor for Easton. Welcome.
Easton Ward, which is where we are now. And I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to my fellow member, Tim, to Easton this evening.
Thank you.
Well, indeed. And I feel very welcomed by you to the Easton Community Centre because you are on the management committee of this very building.
I am. And what a great building it is, too. What a great neighbourhood it is, and it's an absolute privilege to serve local residents, community groups. It's an absolute privilege.
It's a delight to have you in. A quick bit of housekeeping with both of you. Tim Kent, you have been a serving councillor for how long?
About 14 years.
What prompted your decision to join local politics?
I was nagged a lot. I was a council officer before I became a councillor, and I just thought you could actually get something done.
Okay, council officer doing what?
At the time, I used to work in democratic services as an advisor to councillors.
Excellent. Well done. And Afzal Shah, same question to you. How long have you been a councillor and why?
I've been a councillor for 7 years and my parents got burgled. I felt that the police were taking the challenge of burglaries seriously. So I actually represented over 100 victims of very serious burglaries, targeted burglaries. And the response that I got from the new Police and Crime Commissioner then was very poor, and I just felt that it's time to step up to the plate and make sure that we represent people who've been affected by serious issues. And people have every right to live in a safe environment, especially in their homes.
I hear, hear. The venerable Police and Crime Commissioner has decided that a third term is beyond her capability or her desire. There is an opportunity for you to put yourself in the position.
I'm actually, I've been serving on the Police and Crime panel for 6 years. In fact, we've got a meeting next week in Taunton. And I was offered the opportunity to stand as Police and Crime Commissioner candidate, but my children are young. And it's a 24/7 role, perhaps in the future. But I think that really my focus needs to be for the good people of Easton, first and foremost.
Well, I guess since we've brought it up, a question to you both. You have been serving councillors, Afzal in your case, for all but 1 year of Sue Mount-Stevens' tenure as Police and Crime Commissioner. She is leaving. What sort of a job has she done? She's seen a number of chief constables. She has overseen a centralised decentralisation and the shutting down of a number of police stations, only then to rewind and start opening temporary police stations 150 yards from where she shut them down. What sort of a job has Sue Mount-Stevens done for the city, and did it represent value for money?
Who would you like to ask first?
You are both equally democratically elected to join in this democratic conversation.
I'll go first, and then Afzal can follow up with a lot more detail. I mean, all I would say is, as a local ward council, we've seen over two-thirds of our local policing cut. Now, I certainly do not blame the Police and Crime Commissioner for all of that. We're aware that they work within the budget set for them by central government. But for such a savaging of local policing has basically meant that on the ground it's very, very difficult for communities. Added to that, one mistake I think she did make, and this was a big mistake, was getting rid of the specialist drug team. I think though they were able to really interrupt some of the worst elements of the drug dealing market, they do not exist anymore. That has meant a lot of intelligence has been lost. And certainly we have seen a real increase in our community then in the antisocial behaviour around drug dealing, which is sort of what worries me as a local councillor.
Afsal?
So just pick up on Tim's point, the phenomenon, if you can call it that. In fact, this has been going on for many years, so it's not really a new phenomenon. But county lines is a massive issue. There's a lot of money in it. Ultimately, it boils down to money. But you're talking about money. The government, they have made savage cuts in the past decade. We've lost over 600 police officers in the Avon and Somerset area. And even if we get a few hundred back, with all due respect, the cuts have been so savage. Going back to Sue Monk Stevens, I think her first term was extremely poor. I won't even give her a C minus, but she's definitely. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, I'm the longest serving councillor from Bristol City Council on the Police and Crime Panel, so I've got a bit of an insight there. However, to her credit, her second term has been much better. But I wonder how much of that credit is actually down to the Chief Constable, Andy Marsh. I know that Andy's been on this show to speak in, but there are very difficult decisions to actually make. But you don't start off as a new Chief as a new Police and Crime Commissioner. But the first thing that you do is to fire the existing Chief Constable, Colin Port.
Yeah, who was, you know, less than 6 months away from retiring anyway or something. I mean, that was an enormous own goal that she scored. Giving it somebody who is about to retire a whole bunch of employment legislation behind him to say, actually, you owe me tons of money.
Absolutely. And so in 8 years, we've been through 4 chief constables. Now, that doesn't...
Well, to be fair, one of them was only acting. John, what's his chops, was only acting.
John Long.
Yes, John Ross. John Ross.
But even so...
It's nearly as bad as the mayor of chief executives, really, isn't it?
Well, we'll get on to Ms. Klonowski presently.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, we'll come on to that. But at least the mayor's done a good job. but I would say, you know, in terms of Sue Mark Stevens, no, I think the second term has actually been a significant improvement. And I wish her well for all her future aspirations. But we've got very difficult decisions to make. I know that we've had a precept rise. Recently, of just below 5%, and that money is actually being used to make sure that more police officers are recruited. But one thing I will say, Avon and Somerset Constabulary is leading the way nationally in the use of data analytics.
Mm-hmm.
So IT and augmented reality as well, they are leading the way. Obviously, have to have checks and balances, you know, because that data harvesting needs to be used in a responsible way. But we do have the College of Policing and other checks and balances. But we also know that the Met Police, that they're now starting to use facial recognition technology. It's just that where do we end up? You know, we've had Michael O'Leary, the boss of Ryanair, saying that Muslims, and I'm a Muslim, saying that Muslims, especially Muslim men, just because they are Muslim and because they're men, that they should be subjected to more strenuous checks at airports. So, so you know, we have to be very careful what we do with that data. You know, if you're young and black, stop and search, 6 times more likely to be stopped in the constabulary area. If you're a Muslim, you know, there is the potential. I have been reassured mm-hmm. by the Chief Constable and the Police and Crime Commissioner that that will definitely not be the case, but... It's very important that we do look at the bigger picture. But it's good to see that we are using, that we are ahead of the curve in the use of technology.
Okay, let's talk about the squandering of money. Shut Southmead Police Station, shut Trinity Road Police Station, which is still on the market. And then you use officers' hours driving suspects to and from Portishead. This is fully professional police officers who have more than a decade of experience essentially being a taxi for people to and from North Somerset. That is a lunatic waste of revenue and man hours.
Well, yes. I mean, a story given to us actually by a local police officer in South Bristol is that the taking people to the cells at Canesham, which is where they would
do... Oh, it's Canesham, yes. Sorry.
Yes, which is where they would
Canesham
do...
Canesham and Patchway as well.
And Patchway, okay, I didn't know about that. It means that they really have to think about whether they arrest somebody or not. And it was said to us that we had an incident with a youth with a machete in the park, and the reason that they would not have arrested him, even though he was with a machete in the park was because they couldn't spend the time booking him in to the sales in Keynesham. That is remarkable.
It doesn't smell of value for money to me.
It does not.
Absol?
Yeah, a lot of questions to be asked. Again, difficult decisions to be made. It's a shame that we've had loss of estate. You know, Western Supermare, Trinity Road, literally just around the corner, although they will have some kind of presence, some kind of very minimal presence.
I mean, that was a purpose-built police station with a lot of cells in the middle of town that is no more than 25 years old.
I absolutely understand the point you're making. However, if you walk past or drive past Trinity Road Police Station, it really does look like a fortress. And
well, where would you like to keep your misdemeanors and petty criminals?
But I'm just saying that, you know, right on the doorstep of such a diverse part of Bristol, I'll be glad to see the back of Trinity Road. However, we do have Kenneth Steele House on the feeder road that will be used by officers, so they are looking to see how that can be used. But I completely agree that, you know, police officers need to be seen. You know, the first responsibility of any state, any government, any administration is the safety of its citizens. So that has to be a priority. And when I talk to a lot of people, they say, look, we don't mind paying more tax. We're happy to pay more council tax. But we do want to see police officers on the ground. People feel reassured.
Well,
I really do.
I think it would be nice if when, for instance, you mentioned the county lines, when the end product of the county lines issue, which is low-level criminality to sustain a drug habit, when that, you know, you have your garage broken into and they nick your bike or your lawnmower, whatever it is, it would be nice to see somebody after you phone up and report that instead of just getting a crime reference number and then the suggestion that you should get in touch with your insurance company. Crime isn't being tackled, it's just being administered differently.
And also cyber crime as well. It's a massive issue and a lot of people still need to understand, especially small businesses, about the whole gamut of cyber crime. There have been some horror stories recently of people being duped. So I think the more money needs to be spent on that. I know that they're taking it seriously at Avon and Somerset, but the bottom line is ultimately it does boil down to money. I mean, they've got a budget of around a third of £1 billion, and it's a very significant organisation, but they are using technology well. I mean, one thing I will say, they use technology well, but the bottom line is, me personally, I would like to see more police officers on the ground.
Tim, what is the crime level like in your ward?
Well, it is in some patches on the higher side. I don't want to say that it is overrunning the streets. That would be a ridiculous thing to say. I mean, mostly Hetgrove and Whitchurch Park is a safe place to be. I have no problems or concerns walking the streets at night. But there are issues with young people. There are issues with young people being connected with drug dealers in the area. I mean, we did do some work with Operation Topaz, which is there to try to disrupt. And that's the element of young people being groomed, but perhaps not in the sexual way, but to exploit them to work, you know, by drug dealers. So we've been trying to do a bit of work around that. And I've got to say, some of the people who work in Operation Topaz are amazing. I mean, so often we're here talking about the bad things. There are some really great initiatives happening with Avon and Somerset.
There's some great police officers out there as well.
I mean they're holding the line. There's very, very few of them. I feel very sympathetic towards the police officers. There's very, very few to hold that line, and we do need more police officers. It's certainly right the government went far too far. There's no doubt about that in its reduction of funding. I think what they saw was a fall in crime, and they thought, we can just cut then the police numbers. What they've now discovered is that has a fundamental effect on the ability of the police to function as a service.
Well, here's a nice statistic. Apparently, the Crown Prosecution Service will bring less than 5% of rapes to trial. So the other side of that statistic is you can get raped 20 times before you can expect a conviction. So, as the authors and indeed the people who sign the checks locally to prevent that kind of thing, you know, how can we ameliorate the situation?
So I think police and crime commissioners, something within their remit is to set the policing priorities and one of the policing priorities, absolutely agree, should be to take an absolute, and I really mean this, an absolute zero tolerance approach, and to reassure victims that their cases will be taken as far as possible in terms of prosecution. And it's not just about money. It should never be about money. Certainly with the conversations I've had with Sue Mount Stevens, she does take it very seriously. But I would also say that perhaps if we need to reinforce it through legislation, we need to do that. But also I think that the Crown Prosecution Service really need to look at the practices of the Crown Prosecution Services as well. Ultimately, they are the ones that will look at the burden of proof, the level of proof, okay, and whether it's in the public interest to actually prosecute. But I absolutely agree. I mean, because it destroys lives. There can be no room for any error in that. Anybody that has the bravery and the courage to go to the police in the first place to report something of that nature should be given all the resources, all the help they need.
How responsible should the council feel for the removal of youth centres, of children's services, and for the preventative areas, which is now being picked up and being exploited by the County Lines gangs, for instance, or other, you know, the scooter gangs, for instance? You know, there's a lot of unpleasantness because there isn't other stuff for young people to do, because that's been removed.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of councils, because of the reduction in funding, had to find places to save money. And one of the places that went after were the youth budgets.
Is that because they don't vote? Because they can't vote?
Sure, I think a lot of that was a factor. I think it was because they're a slightly hidden service, perhaps from the normal voter. In the top priority of what voters wanted to protect, it wasn't seen as a top priority. Also in this, there was some re-changing on how youth services would work. Some of it was good, about trying to release more youth workers out into the community to work directly with people rather than just being stuck in buildings. Where the mistake was made is, if you've got then no services to point those young people onto, you're really not being able to cure anything. You're going out there talking with young people and they go, well, there's nothing to do. They're right. There is nothing to do because the youth centre and maybe other provision that was there for them has been lost. So, you know, that has been an issue. It's not the only one. I mean, there's been also, of course, a lot of tightening of budgets around social services. So there were, and there are still some really good practice out there of trying to work with and support families. But talking with some of the head teachers in my ward, they've said the reduction of that support of working with families which are having difficulties has had a serious impact then on the school, on behaviour and on children's futures. I mean, added to that of which, I then come back, of course, to the SEND crisis. A lot of the kids are getting excluded from school in their teens. And then if they're excluded, you know what path they're going to take. Have special educational needs or disabilities.
Martin Somers, I'm going to bring you in here because you have first-hand experience of this. What are you seeing and how has it changed over the last decade or so?
Well, as Tim will know, the special needs budget comes out of the local authority's budget. But of course, it's not. It's, in other words, the more special needs they recognise, the more money they've got to spend. And you took the council to court, I believe, because they were not fulfilling their statutory responsibility.
Parents to the council.
Parents, but you helped them to do that.
I was slightly involved.
Yes. Okay, I'm not saying it was you. All right. But the problem is, I mean, I work with special needs children as a living, is that, again, it's a Cinderella situation. The people who are in the situation know, but others don't. And of course, for local authorities, the money for things like this shouldn't be a local lottery, depending upon what the local authority can afford. That's silly. Of course, it then leads to a situation where local authorities either overtly or covertly try to push back people who are asking for help, and that's just wrong. But nevertheless, the fundamental problem underlying all the things we've been talking about is the stupid austerity policy pursued over the last 10 years, which even the Tory government now recognises was wrong.
Oh, no, they've got tons of money now, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, there's not just one magic money tree, there's a whole forest.
Afzal, you've got some children who are getting towards school starting age. Are you optimistic? Do you feel confident that they're going to be protected and well-educated?
I think there's some incredible teachers out there. Teaching staff do the best they can with the resources they have. But in terms of resources, we've seen town hall budgets cut by 40%. We've seen youth provision by being cut by up to 90% in some constituencies up and down the country. It's been absolutely savage. It has a knock-on effect. It actually does. And the last decade, we've seen an increase in knife crime as well. I was talking to the Assistant Police and Crime Commissioner just last week for West Midlands Police. They've seen knife crime increase threefold just in the past 5 years. Thankfully, we don't have such a huge problem in Bristol, but ultimately, if you don't have diversionary activity, if you don't have some kind of something positive which young people can actually put their energies into, they are going to go elsewhere. So they could potentially end up in drug dealing, but they can also end up being expelled from school. And some of those individuals end up going to PRUs, pupil referral units, which actually costs a ton of money. It's not just about money, but yeah, it is a false economy, because where you cut in one place, you're actually having to subsidise in another. It's just absolutely ludicrous. We are fortunate that in Bristol, we are looking at the data to look at how we can best support families and taking a public health approach.
So working forwards from the Glasgow model.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, we'll come back and talk about that. We're going to pause for a piece of music. It's just about 28 minutes past six. We're coming back. We're going to talk about spending and spending on marquee projects. You're both equally complicit. This is Elvis Costello.
Shrink and the kitchen sink. Write my name in heaven, invisible ink. I just woke up from dreaming, I think. You can take me over, you can give me a lift. You can take me under, you can give me a slip. Take off everything, or tell me all the truth. Like a lady in the chamber and another in the club. Don't move a muscle in it, don't even flinch. You can miss me by just inch by inch, inch by inch. Inch by inch, inch by inch. You can pull it up again, inch by inch. Inch by inch, those pulses race. I long to see that look upon your face. You can take me outside, you can take me apart. You can take me upstairs, you can take me to heart. You made me love you and you thought you were smart. Don't try to stop me now, it's only to start. Don't move a muscle, baby. Don't even flinch. You can miss me by just inch by inch, inch by inch, inch by inch, inch by inch. You can pull me up again, inch by inch, inch by inch. As pulses race, I long to see that look upon your face. I long to see that look upon your face. I long to see that look upon your face.
Yes, Elvis Costello, inch by inch. And I'm delighted to say inch by inch, we are inching 15 years after the event towards an arena for Bristol. God almighty, this has been glacial. Let's talk about the decisions that have been made recently, Afzal Shah, Labour Councillor for Easton, because you are on the Planning Committee.
Yes.
So, how did you vote regarding the Temple Island development?
So we had a free vote, and at the time I chose to abstain. The reason why I chose to abstain, I felt I didn't have enough information to make an informed decision, and in my heart I will say at the time that I wanted the arena to be built just a stone's throw away from my ward, at the old diesel depot.
Indeed. And then YTL had their Filton Brabazon hangar vote at the planning committee last Tuesday. How did you vote?
So I voted for it.
Why?
A, it public purse, public finances. We don't need to use a penny to actually build the arena itself or to actually run it. It's great for Bristol. It's a 17,000 seater facility, which will have, which I feel is well placed geographically to actually take on some of the other facilities such as Exeter or Cardiff. And I just feel that it's an iconic building and it's being put to good use. And I was a little bit sceptical until two things happened. One, I went there on a site visit with a few other local residents from here, completely with an open mind. It was one of their own guided tours. They take you around on a bus with a number of other individuals. And I was, you know, the sheer scale of the place is incredible. But then I still thought, okay, we're going to have major challenges with transport. So I still wasn't sure. And then they had the massive attack gig. And that proved, actually, it could do it. And only then I thought, okay, you know what? This is the real this has some real potential. But even then, when we go into a planned committee, we absolutely must go in with an open mind. We have to look at the facts, and we have to look at the officer's recommendation, and we're able to question the officers as well. And we've got a lot of information in front of us, and we can condition it as well. So there has been quite a bit of conditioning as well.
Interesting. Tim Kent, same set of questions to you. How did you vote for the Temple Island development?
Well, when it went to the special council meeting, I voted that it should have stayed at Temple. I voted that it should that the arena should have stayed at Temple Island. When the mayor just recently made the decision on Temple Island to hand the site to LNG, I was one of the five councillors that did call that in, because a lot of us could not understand how you could be certain you had best value when there had been no competitive process at all.
Well, so far there is absolutely no value from Temple Island, and Legal & General, which is a financial services and mutual company with no track record of house building, I'm staggered that Marvin is very keen to spend an extra £32 million on the Temple Island square mile to make sure that everything is perfectly prepared for Legal & General to start building houses.
Well, the decision certainly surprises us as well. I think the mistake there is that there's been no competitive tender on that site at all. It has just been handed to LNG. Good business by LNG, no doubt about that, because they've managed to go in and they've managed to set the value of that land. That's pretty unusual, that when you look to sell something, the person who wants to buy it is the one who tells you what the price is. And as you say, actually, it comes with a large amount of public subsidy. I mean, that decision has now been made, and unless there's a change of leadership, it will go through. I guess that's the question people will face in May.
Well, that decision was made without the full council being in full grasp of the full facts. Is it fair to say that?
Well, under our constitution, I would say around 90% plus of the power of the council sits with the mayor. So the reality is, even if full council has the full grasp of the facts, they cannot actually overrule the mayor.
Okay. This is going back a couple of weeks. There was an error publication of a document pursuant to Temple Island, with some of the redactions later coming in. It's 400 and something pages long. I didn't read it. Frankly, I'm not sure that many people have read it. But you're talking about huge sums of money. We were talking about Children's Services just now. We were talking about police officers on the street. £32 million on top of the £12 million that has already been spent on that square mile next to Temple Meads. That money has to come from somewhere, and it seems to be coming from my pocket and everybody else who pays council tax in this city.
Well, actually, we've paid substantially more than that for that site. So you've got the bridge as well. I don't think that's in the 12 million. So that's about another 10 million. You've okay. got the land is as well. I don't think we've ever paid for the land. I think we owe somebody for that land. So I think you'll discover there is a debt against the council on the ownership of that land, and because it was transferred to us by probably Homes England or the Regional Development Agency at the time, the Southwest Regional Development Agency. And that's not unusual. There were several sites, including one being Hengrove Park in my own ward, mm-hmm. where that land was transferred
we'll get onto that.
With a technical debt against it. Whether we'll ever have to pay it or not, I do not know. But there is actually substantially more public money that's tied up on that site. And, I mean, I understand that during the call-in, I wasn't present myself at the meeting, but one of the defences for handing the site to LNG was nobody else was interested in it. It's a bit like putting something for sale in the basement, locking the basement up, and then saying the reason the item didn't sell is because nobody came along to buy it. It is a truly ludicrous defence.
That's a nice image. I'm going to read from the end of page 13 and the top of page 14 from the calling in document. You, Gary Hopkins, and three other councillors called in the decision about what we, I think, are agreed on was an executive decision by the Mayor's office to award Legal & General, a financial services company, I will repeat that, a financial services company, to build seven tower blocks with phase two, an alleged phase two, being a conference centre and hotel development. That's phase two. But this is under proportionality. At the bottom of page 13, proportionality of fiscal rectitude. Proportionality. This is not demonstrated. We see a heads of terms that is admitted places no obligation on. Oh, flip it. I have to. I'll refresh that and get back to it. But essentially, the subtext is we need to be insulated against the misuse of public money and. And this is my favourite moment of the whole thing. There we go. Now I've got it. Proportionality. This is not demonstrated. We see a heads of terms and is admitted places. No obligation. We propose to give a completely unconditional long lease after spending millions of pounds on public money preparing the site. None of this is proposed under democratic control as all decisions are delegated. Delegated to whom? We don't know. But it goes down. It's important when scrutinising a deal not just to listen to the salesmen that have paved the way to promote it and are paid to do so in the light of your bus trip around Filton Airfield, but if to check that the caveats are and the supporting advice are also there to check on other on what other parties are getting out of this. And if, therefore, we should consider an alternative way forward. The legislation, this legislation, is in place so that this arrangement skirts partly around the purpose. It seeks to prevent either corruption or poor decision-making that puts public money at risk. So, Afzal Shah, you're on the Planning Committee. Is there corruption and is public money at risk of being misspent?
I can absolutely say, and I hate to use the term, but, you know, just to quote George Bush, read my lips, there is absolutely no corruption.
How many times has Marvin Rees been on holiday to Malaysia recently, since he became mayor? Well, yes, he's been on a number of fact-finding missions with his family.
I can't possibly comment on any trips abroad. I think that's something that you can...
It's sensitive information on the council website.
But there is something that I'd just like to pick up. Just a slight clarification. Billy, you did say that LNG has no track record of you know, investing or building homes. Technically, that's not true. They've invested £250 million in the Temple Quarter area. And one of the major investments that they've made there is for 525 buy-to-rent homes in the Temple Quarter area. So,
are they completed? Are they fully occupied?
No, they are in the process. But
who's building them?
I'll have to get back to you on that. I'll have to seek clarification on that. But that money is already in place. They're already in the process of actually building them. They've also financed the building that the HMRC are occupying there. Three Glass Wharf is one there. So they do. So this is not a company that does not have a track record in the area. I mean, Temple Quarter is just a stone's throw away from there. So they do have a footprint there. And I think we have to be careful here. We're not talking about Amazon or Goldman Sachs or you know, one of these big companies that is seeking to cut and run from this country and is irresponsible, doesn't pay their taxes. I mean, we have to remember that a lot of the money that they are custodians of are from public sector finances, pension pots for people working in town halls up around the country.
Yeah, well, exactly the same as the owners of Bristol Airport with their pension pot from the schools in Ontario and Canada. That really doesn't wash with me, I'm afraid. Why is the council spending eye-watering amounts of money preparing a site for this company to make a profit, to pay dividends to shareholders?
So some of that money would have gone on decontamination and clearing up, which they have to do. As you know, that place has been vacant for decades. Does Bristol need quality conference facilities?
No, well, frankly.
I think so. I mean, you know, that we talk about, you know, Bristol being the only core city, right? We talk about Bristol being the only core city that is a net contributor to the Exchequer. Yet, with all due respect, if we want to attract these kind of companies to come and invest in Bristol and to showcase in Bristol, do we really have the facilities for them to actually come here?
Technology is galloping forwards all of the time. The 5G rollout, this coronavirus even, it feeds into it. People are going to conference digitally from now on. You're talking about a very 20th century business model, needing to get thousands of people into a conference centre, filling up the hotel rooms, all of that. It's done. People work from home now. This, I'm holding up a smartphone, that is an everything machine. That's not just for making and receiving telephone calls and sending and receiving text messages. It's an everything machine, and everybody has one now. We don't need conference centres.
Do you not think that it would add that it would bring a lot of money to Bristol's economy, and it would benefit many small businesses as well? So I know that when I've spoken to some of the businesses in this area, not all of them, but the ones that I've engaged with, they actually welcome that. And we are talking about Temple Meads as well. They with their expansion and the upgrading of facilities there, we're looking at the doubling of passengers there, 22 million people per year. Right on the doorstep of Temple Meads, if you've got these kind of facilities, they will be used. And it does bring a lot of money into Bristol. £300 million development by the University of Bristol.
Yeah, I'm fully
above
behind
our weight,
all of that. But actually,
we do need this
with the full connectivity and all of the business cases you've just presented to me for a conference centre and hotel. That would have been much better served by an arena that people could have walked to who live in the city, and people from without the city could have gotten to the train.
Can we really afford to spend nearly £200 million on an arena, on a 12,000-seater arena, when we can actually have one in the north of the city that is fully funded?
Well, you're spending £32 million on top of £22 million, so that's £64 million for nothing, so Legal & General can build houses.
but we will actually recoup that cost in terms of the business rates and all of the other costs.
I can't see it happening. If let's look at Finsel's reach. I know it's taken a while.
We've Tim had Kent, Channel 4 move there recently.
Tim Kent, you were on the planning. Well, there are 90 Channel 4 jobs there, which will last for who knows how long. They're also mainly gig economy jobs. They are not staff jobs. They're freelancers who are down to do a small project and then go. You were on the planning committee, Tim Kent, when Finsel's reach was pushed through by a shower of Irish cowboys. 2008, I believe, was when it got planning permission.
I'm going to believe you that I was on the planning committee in 2008.
Okay, and the provision of Finsel's reach was for 88 Section 106 affordable housing units.
Well, certainly I would have expected there would have been some affordable housing units.
How many have been delivered?
I have absolutely no idea, but I think you're going to tell me.
Zero.
Right, well, I mean, of course.
The redevelopment of the General Hospital on Guinea Street.
Yeah.
Section 106 provision, 61 affordable housing units. Mm. How many were delivered?
I'm going to guess zero.
Correct.
I got that one.
All of the Harbourside development that's gone on in the last 20 years, how many of those do you think provided Section 106 affordable housing units? Bear in mind, there are over 9,000 domestic units have gone in the Harbourside since 1996.
I have no idea, but I suspect it's very low.
15.
And what you're pointing to here is a problem of an imbalance within the law that allows developers to dictate what is the affordability. So the affordability agreements that they can push through and say that exempts them from delivering social housing guarantees developers a 20 to 25% profit margin. I think anybody would suggest that that is excessive. But what really gets me is sometimes is the land is overpriced within those affordability agreements and that actually they should never have paid those prices for the land. The land value should reflect the need to deliver at least 30%, ideally 40% social housing. I mean, this has been an ongoing issue for 20 years or so. I would say, actually, and I do not normally compliment the mayor, I do think since he's come to office, he has attempted to try to address this. It is a difficult thing to address because the law is not on our side. And as you all know, local councils have very little ability to work outside of the law. We live in a very centralised system of governance here in this country. I don't praise the mayor too often. In fact, I imagine you're shocked that I'm giving any praise at all. But I do think he has tried to address this. And it is something, I'm going to say, councils have been bringing up for quite a while, which is the secrecy also around affordability agreements.
How hard has he tried? Because Sandy Horriven, the Green Party candidate for mayor, came out with a spectacular speech this week. Not spectacular in as much as I enjoyed it, but he said, Marvin Rees, who's been mayor of Bristol for nearly 5 years, has delivered 150 council homes. That is 30 homes a year or 2.5 homes a month, if you will. That's not a glowing record, Afzal Shah, is it?
I can absolutely say that home building is amongst his top priorities. In terms of those figures, I'd have to check. I'm more than happy to get back to you on that.
I have no reason to believe Sandy Horriven would go around making lies up, and I am merely quoting his speech.
One thing that we can say is that sitting on the development committee, I know that we're getting a lot of applications coming to us. I was on the committee that approved over 1,400 homes to be built in Tim's ward. It is your ward, isn't it?
Well, it is, but of course, as you're aware, when that approval went through, it was in breach of the neighbourhood plan, which was a great shame because residents have spent 2 years developing a good plan, balancing out housing with also the need for park and wildlife and sports facilities. And I think if only the council had worked closer with the community to ensure their plan matched that, which the housing numbers were not greatly different. I mean, second time round was the exact same plan, minus chopping down 20 trees. I mean, it really was taking the mick that they were trying to make out that this was a completely different plan. It was the same plan.
And what I would say is that, to quote the mayor himself, if you look around Bristol now, you do see cranes everywhere, you know, building homes.
I'm not sure they're building homes. And they're building something. And I'm not sure keen, it's homes.
They are keen to ensure that a significant proportion of that is affordable housing. It really is important that we have affordable housing. Bristol's property market is just skyrocketing. Incredible demand. And in terms of the cost of living crisis, housing is one of the biggest challenges. And I think that if we talk about legacy, I think...
No, I don't think we should talk about legacy, actually. Well, I think
house building.
House building we can talk about. Legacy, I'm very not interested in. And that's in a post-Tony Blair legacy frame of mind. Let's talk transport legacy, shall we, Tim Kent? Because you were the cabinet member for transport when the coalition government dangled a £200 million cheque in front of you for a guided bus system. In fact, you were one of the strongest advocates in the committee for making sure Bristol got their hands on that lovely lolly. Do you regret that decision?
No, I don't regret that decision, because that actually brought some transport investment to Bristol. Now, let's be clear. That transport investment was not going to solve Bristol's problems. It was a start. It was a drop in the ocean. You need significantly more. The only thing I would say is from the time is I do feel it was badged too much as a metro bus system. The reality was... It was some bus improvements, but also too much road. That's my regret from that, and it should have been far more about public transport.
Well, let's look at the detail. Too much road, some of which has now fallen into the new cut, which means that Cumberland Road is closed for the foreseeable future at Spike Island, largely due, it must be said, to the metro bus works that had gone on down along there.
No, quite the opposite. Actually, the metro bus works were supposed to go along there, and that would have seen that wall shored up. But as you'll know, the next mayor moved the metro bus off that route further back onto the road, which meant the works were not done, which were actually in the metro bus budget. Now, I suspect... probably they would have discovered it would have cost a lot more to do than was originally planned.
Well, should we talk about some of the other metro...
That collapse would not have happened if the metro bus followed the route it was supposed to have
followed. Should we talk about some of the other metro bus stuff that didn't happen? You put a nice big road from the airport roundabout down to Long Ashton across Ashton Vale.
Yep, now, South Bristol Link.
Round about the time, there was plans by Stephen Lansdowne and Sport Bristol to put a nice big stadium out on Ashton Vale, which to me suggests that Stephen Lansdowne might own quite a lot of the land on Ashton Vale.
I have no idea what land he owns and what land he does not own.
Let's just surmise and speculate that maybe Stephen Lansdowne owns that land, which he picked up for a song, just over £1,500 an acre as agricultural brownfield land about 15 years ago.
Well he overpaid then, because a lot of it got made a town green. Because if it's made of tan green, it's actually worth negative money.
Well, you say that now that it has a nice metro bus route put brand new through it with bus links, that has all of a sudden in a thrice become prime development land for housing, and that prime development housing land goes for over £1 million an acre,
What's going on there, Tim?
Yeah.
£1,500 an acre, my God.
Well, it seems like he's a good businessman. I mean, the key thing of the South Bristol Link is that the bus has never run. That is the shame of what's happened, and that is disgraceful. What we've also had is we've had, and this time I'm not attacking your mayor, we've had a metro mayor go out there and spin a tale. He spinned a tale that, oh, we can't run the bus because it will require subsidy, and that's against our policy. We need to be absolutely clear. It was written down in our bid to government that that bus would run and it would be subsidised. It was recognised it needed subsidy. And what we've had is a metro mayor come along who basically clearly does not care about public transport, because he sat for 3 years without even bringing a bus strategy forward.
Can I just ask you a question,
Tim? Spent 3 years going backwards rather than forwards.
Tim, so we're in Easton. We've got Stapleton Road and we've got the M32 that actually cuts straight through the ward. How come the inner city areas have been completely cut out from the metro bus?
Well, I'm sure you'll recall that actually there was a metro bus route going to run through Easton, but the Labour Transport executive member a couple of years before me pulled it.
Okay, time is against us, Tim. I know you need to get away to go and cook the dinner. So let's talk about the overspend. The 200 million quid went up in a thrice. Why did the ticketing system go over time and over budget by 18 months and £12 million?
I feel one of the mistakes now looking at this after completion is gold plating.
Oh, no, believe me, it's not completed. Gypsy Patch Lane closed yesterday for 8 months.
Yeah.
One of the main arterial routes from Patchway to the Mall is now closed for 8 months.
And many of my residents are still waiting for their bus stop to be delivered. We've got a missing bus stop. We've been asking for it now for over a year.
You were on the committee. But, people are pointing the finger at you for this.
Well, I'm pointing the finger back in the sense that what I'm saying is I think one of the mistakes with these projects is that people gold plate them. What they do is they put in their things. So one of the big things...
What
I'm saying is within the council, there's a tendency of doing this. So as an example, a massive expansion of our data network was paid for through Metrobus. Most people don't realise that. And it is utterly underused. The fact we've got this whole data
network. Just because
nobody's
using the bloody bus.
So
even the guy who runs First Bus said this is a crappy service.
But we've also now spending around £250,000 for each bus stop. So I want two Metro bus stops. Well, one stop, two sides of the road added. They've agreed to add it. And then they came out to say the price was £500,000.
Who's paying for that?
Well, what's happened is taxpayers have paid for that. And this is the problem sometimes when we get these large infrastructure schemes.
So I'm paying for that.
Gold plate them. We all pay for these things out of our taxes.
Okay.
What is important, though, is I don't think we want to get hung up here on...
No,
we don't want to get hung up here on the faults of Metrobus and say we should not improve public transport. Because if we want to, in any way, tackle the issue of climate crisis, if we want to tackle air pollution, if we want to reduce congestion in this city, there's one route to do that, and that's public transport, and the best route to do that is through the bus. I mean, I know the mayor's got this fantasy idea of an underground system that will cost billions of pounds.
Well, that's complete
and
lunacy.
If you want gold plating, there
is
a scheme.
Utter lunacy. But he's been to China a few times to do R&D
for
that.
The bus is the practical route which will cost us far less to
You don't need that kind of vision. How many diesel buses are running on the Metrobus route improving Bristol's air quality?
Far too many diesel buses, because when I was in charge, I actually put through that diesel was not acceptable and that there, as a minimum, it had to be biogas or electric. But I'm afraid after we lost office, that spec got changed back to diesel.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say at least when I was in charge. So are you prepared to admit you are partly responsible for the absolute and unmitigated disaster that Metrobus has proved to be?
Oh, I'm happy to admit that I helped win couple of £100 million of funding for this city, the largest investment in public transport we've had probably since Brunel. I'm happy to admit that we've got a bus service with some investment in. I'm happy to admit that that's the beginning, but we need to go far further. If you think in any way I'd apologise, no, not at all, because actually I think that was one of the best things that has happened. Most people who use the Metrobus are happy with the service. What we need to do now is roll that out in a more affordable way.
Who are you speaking to, Tom?
In a more affordable way across our city. Who have you spoken to who are not happy who use it?
I've spoken to a lot of people.
Why doesn't it go to the door of Temple Meads like you promised?
It doesn't go to the door of Temple Meads because the mayor changed the route.
You promised, Tim. You promised.
Well, any promise of any system lasts right up to when the new guy gets elected and changes the route. If you remember, George Ferguson actually got elected to cancel the Metrobus. He broke that promise, but instead he changed the route.
Okay.
That was a fundamental mistake, by the way, moving away from Temple Meads, just as moving the arena away from Temple Meads.
Are you standing for re-election in May?
I will be, yes.
Okay, good. Tim Kent, thank you. Afzal Shah, have you got time to stay with us after the news?
I can stay for another 5 minutes.
Great, excellent. We'll have another 5 minutes knocking lumps out of you after the news at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.